raised on the east coast of Ireland in both County Meath and Wexford. Singer-songwriter and producer Wallace Bird has been based in Berlin for some years now. When we last spoke to Wallace, she was just about to embark on a mini Irish tour and had begun work on her seventh studio album. Now, a total of just 50 weeks of work later, the album is set to be revealed to the public. It's called Hands. It'll be released on Friday, and Wallace will be joining me to talk about it from Berlin in just a few moments' time. But let's listen to how the album opens, a track called Go.
The moon is saying right now, she says I have to start living, so what I'll do right now is go. I'll open up my hands, I'm gonna get what I'm giving, I'm gonna give it right now. I know.
There we go, the opening track on Wallace Bird's new album Go, and delighted to have Wallace join me on the programme this evening from Berlin. I'll never move on if I don't go now. You're not a person that I would think of as ever standing still and ever saying, oh, I'll just wallow in this present moment now and enjoy it all and do nothing. But there's a real statement of intent in that opening track, Wallace.
Well, thanks, Sean. Yeah, it's I guess it's moving forward from where we've all been in the last couple of years. And it's a correct place to begin a record with something slightly gentle, very open. It's supposed to feel like an embrace and just a gentle nudge to say, let's go together. And even hearing the song now, it gives me emotion because it was so intuitively written, so quickly written, and it's just a culmination of everything that has come before to that point. So it feels really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So was there a did you have a kind of some kind of trepidation? I think a lot of people had, number myself among them. You know, when lockdown started to lift and all that type of thing, we were glad to feel and see it happening. But there was a little bit of, there's a person near me. Oh, I have to go. Oh, I have to go out. I have to go into the shop. I have to do these things. There was a little bit of fear around it, wasn't there?
Of course, yeah. I mean, we had to retract completely and go inwards and stay away from others. We're going to be developing our feelings from this for a long time to come. So that's the album is entirely written about that space, you know, the 2019 to 2021. So I really hope, in a sense, that the songwriting that I chose, the subjects that I chose to talk about, that they'll remind us of how it felt. There was something very insular and terrifying, but also it really encouraged us to look deep within, I feel, and we're still figuring out what that is.
And you follow up Go with a track that says quite simply, what's wrong with changing? And you bring us through, I suppose, a number of events from your own life, an 18-year-old where you recognise now that you were educated but uninformed. You bring us to your time in London in the Cameron era. You bring us through to the 2015 referendum on gay marriage and through a number of political aspects of, I suppose, of life. And the whole thing that you're saying is, don't be afraid of change. This is how we live, by change on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the only thing that's certain. It makes me very comfortable. Change, chaos, uncertainty makes me very comfortable because I'm assured that it will happen. I work hard to go with the flow. I work hard to be a collaborator, you know, be at ease with life. Mm. I mean, it takes practice, but it's helped me overcome any kind of, everything in life is something to be challenged by, and I enjoy it. So it's often really scary when we're moving through times such as we are right now, which is such intense change in everything. We're becoming emotionally aware of each other, and that's also gets us irate and helps us understand. And then we feel like we are in a safe space to explain the recipe of ourselves. And It's really interesting time to be alive right now. You know, emotions are high. And I think the most important thing now is just to say, relax, everybody relax and just listen, see what happens. And then, you know, move forward. Yeah.
The other thing, I mean, you're talking on a large scale there in terms of some of the big world political events, and you certainly address that across the record. There's nothing surprising that that would be there in a record from you, Wallace. But this is incredibly personal as well, not least of which is the title of the album itself and the image on the front of the on the album cover.
Yeah, it's my own hand. You see, I was in an accident when I was a toddler. I was 18 months old and I fell under a lawnmower and cut all my fingers off. So I have 4.5 fingers, I call it. So the album is called Hands, 9.5 songs for 9.5 fingers, you know, so it's a bit of crack. But it does. Hands tell such an intense private story about yourself. Oftentimes if somebody holds your hand, it's one of the most emotionally connecting and erotic things. It's all of these really intense emotions connected around hands. And also, if you don't have a standard hand or a paw, there's always ways to connect or to work and to flourish, really. So it's also about reaching out in a time when we had to retract. And also the idea of begging, asking for help, offering help, they're both valid and they should both be seen as worthy of connection. So, it's a loaded
yeah,
title.
Yeah, for sure. But let us remember that the majority of your, I think it's safe to say your songwriting, the majority of your performance is done as a guitarist, where you're using both hands in a different way from maybe somebody who doesn't have this type of hand that you have, but that's what you're doing. You have made that challenge a real positive in your life. Let me listen to a song called Lose Myself Completely, because this is pretty personal as well, and this is all about change. Let's have a listen. Yeah. To play that lyric for myself several times. I lose myself completely in the drink and in the moment. And I thought, that is what Wallace Bird is telling us here. Had drink become an issue, Wallace, or what made you, again, because this is about change, this album, and I think you have stopped drinking. Had it become a problem? Had it become an issue? Or why did you want to address it?
It was something I was leaning on very, very heavily. I was so much so that I was beginning to wonder, was it part of my character to be the drunk mad yoke? And I thought that it helped me create. I thought that it helped me get in touch with my creative side, but it actually just hindered me personally, just hindered and held back. And it was leading into, you know, week-long hangovers and just losing connection with myself and with my loved ones. So, yeah, it was something that needed to, I kind of looked at it and I said, look, if I can't give up, I'm going to try my best to give up now and do it for a year and see how it feels. And so it's just been I'm off it for nearly a year and a half now. And I don't think I'll ever go back, because, I mean, I've given it a good shot, definitely tried it. And there's a point where it just gets... Yeah.
Well, a bit like your opening song says, I'll never move on if I don't go now. There's a touch of that in it.
Here, exactly.
Come here to me. How often do you get up at 6 a.m. in the morning, the hour before the sun, and write songs like songs like dream writing? Are you a morning person? Because that's what you talk about in that song, dream writing.
I'm not a morning person.
I wondered.
So it's definitely not. I'm not. But so that's the exciting thing about being up at that early. It's something kind of magical, a little bit special. And I can see why a lot of people, they say, I like to get up and I like to start working at, you know, 7 a.m. because it's the quiet time. It's the dream time. The unwoken world. I was in a particularly lovely spot when I heard that on the 5th floor. I'm able to look down. I'm on one of the most busy streets in all of Berlin. And just to see it absolutely silent, even the babies were sleeping. It felt like anything was possible. Yeah. Felt like I was in a dream world. Yeah. So.
And one other thing, I mean, we were saying just particularly as we were listening to I Lose Myself Completely, and it's there across several tracks in the album. There's a real bang of the 80s off the album and off the style on the album, isn't there?
There is. There's a lot of nostalgia, which I guess I would have steered away from before because it might have seemed trite. But like you mentioned at the start of the program, I didn't know if the world was going to be coming to some sort of a tectonic end or something. I don't know. Existentialism was there. So I began to turn towards feelings that make me feel energized, alive, and those sounds are from the 80s. This really intense, lyrically clever synth pop really gets my heart racing. And so I just said, you know what, why would I be hindering myself? I'll just go straight into it and just make it very easy for myself and create intuitively and easily. And that was kind of the sounds that I fell upon.
Well, listen, I know that you're going to be doing some gigs at home later in the year, and I'll give people your website details and all of that when we listen to a bit of this song that I want to finish up with, which stopped me in my tracks and had me with a big lump in my throat. Tell me about I'll Never Hide My Love Away, which is one of the quieter songs on the album and absolutely beautiful.
Oh, thank you, Sean. It's about defiant love, all powerful, practiced, defiant love in the face of any sort of ism. I believe that love can cure yourself, and that makes life so much easier and so much more copable. So this is a conversation with a friend to say, no matter what we go through, I will be there for you, and we'll see each other through this. So
great.
It's a song of hope.
Great to speak with you, Wallace. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Sean. Thanks a million.
I'll never hide my love away, not if I've nothing, if I'm angry or scared. I'll never hide my love away.
I'll Never Hide My Love Away, the title of that track from Wallace Bird and her new album Hands, which will be released this Friday. Absolutely wonderful stuff for me at any rate. It's Friday, May the 27th is the release date, as I said. You can find out details about Wallace, her previous work and her touring schedule all on her website, wallacebird.com. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. My next guest spent 12 years tracing the musical heroes of his childhood and making a remarkable documentary. Born in London to Nigerian parents, the singer-songwriter-producer Shiji Iwanika spent his formative years in Lagos during the 1970s oil boom. But political turmoil in the 1980s drove Shiji and his family back to London once again, and he didn't return to his homeland for another 23 years. In his documentary, Elder's Corner, he delves back in time to tell the story of Nigeria's juju and Afrobeat music scene, the music of his childhood. And the film And the film celebrates the pioneers of juju, Afrobeat and other Nigerian musical traditions, mixing archive, interviews and performance footage. What emerges is a voyage of return and discovery, connecting the past to the present through music. Elders Corner will screen tomorrow evening at the Lighthouse Cinema in Dublin as part of the inaugural Africa Day Film Festival in Dublin, which will see four films screen over four nights in the Lighthouse, the Savoy and IFI Cinemas. Delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by Shiji Iwanika on the line from New York. That move, Shiji, from London to Lagos, I think you were about 4 or 5 years old. You were a very young child at the time, at any rate, moving back with your Nigerian parents. Can you remember, can you describe the sorts of music that you were hearing as a young kid? What were you aware of?
Very interesting. Thank you so much for having me. You have to remember in the 70s, Nigeria was flush with petrodollars. And I remember distinctly hearing a lot of juju music. It was a time, for me, it was like, there seemed to be a party every corner you turned. It was a time of festivity and celebration. And that was pretty obvious. It was thick in the air. You heard it in passing cars and radios. You heard it at all these parties people threw. So it was like very celebratory and vibrant. Those made quite an impression on me.
And if you had to put a word or a description on juju music, which is one of the types of music really that you deal with in the documentary, is celebration very much at the heart of it, given the period that we're talking about? As you say, a very dollar-rich Nigeria at that period in time, and a lot of optimism in the country.
Indeed, indeed. You know, it was right on the cusp of the Biafra War had ended a few years before that. And of course, the oil embargo, the war in the Middle East had meant Nigeria was flush with petrodollars. So juju music is typically derived from traditional Yoruba music, which you have a lot of percussion instruments, particularly the talking drum. And, you know, that drives all of that. But juju music evolved out of that and then began to fuse Western instruments, particularly the Hawaiian guitar. So you have this fusion of traditional Yoruba music with Western influences. And, you know, it made for such a funky and very effective celebratory backdrop for the music for the period.
In your teens then, with your parents, you moved away from Nigeria again. It was a great time in the 70s. Things weren't so hot in political terms in the 80s.
That's right.
A long absence in the intervening period before you went back to make this film, where was the music in your mind at that time? Was it just something that was buried and forgotten? Where did it sit?
Well, it was always there. You know, I had suddenly become turned into a musician. I'd grown into my love for music, kind of evolved out of that, and then grew into my wanting to pursue a career within the arts, which I eventually did. So the music was always there for me, you know, especially the rhythmic aspect of it, and it was whilst I was in America working with some producers out here. They began to, one by one, they began to, well, you're Nigerian, aren't you? You come from a very rich cultural background, you know? Because you have to remember, at this time in the 90s and 2000, when I began my own career, I was driven by a lot of soul music, which is something we heard a lot of whilst I was growing up in Nigeria as well. A lot of music from the Philadelphia and the Motown years. And that influenced me greatly. But it wasn't until I came to America that a few producers began to look at me like, wow, you're Nigerian. It might make more sense for you to begin to sing in your own native tongue. And, you know, it really slowly began to dawn on me that the one thing that could potentially set me apart from my contemporaries was the fact that I had this rich culture behind me. So I began to delve deeper and deeper into my you know, my ethnicity, yeah, and my culture, and the music began to emerge out of that too.
And not only that, you were lucky enough to have a pal who had an extraordinary collection of Nigerian music. I mean, what we see in the film, I don't know what he has left in his apartment, what space he has left in his apartment. There were a lot of LPs. Now, I doubt I have the very exact recording that he played for you, but I do have a recording of one of the songs that he played for you. And this brought back particular memories. Let's just have a little listen first, and you can tell us afterwards what it is and what memories it brought back when you heard it. Tell me who I'm listening to there.
That is actually the late, great Fatai Rolling Dog.
For sure. One of the things about that is that those original versions are very, and were very hard to come by. These musicians barely recorded themselves. And if they had been recorded, they'd lost them. They didn't put much value on that vinyl, on that record of their music.
Indeed, which is a very sad thing. You know, one of the things we did in the film was to have them recreate some of these classics as well. Because like you said, very few of them had copies of their original recordings. You know, they've been lost and forgotten. So I took it upon ourselves, myself and the production team took it upon ourselves to, you know what, put these guys in the studio, let them relive their past and recreate some of these classics. And the results were stunning.
And I interrupted you as you were going down memory lane of that, hearing the original version of Fatai Rolling Dollar.
Fatai Rolling Dollar, yes.
Tell me about the moment you heard that, because I think that was really what sparked you off on this filmic journey that you went on subsequently.
Indeed. Like you said, Lucita played me that very record, and the minute the first strains of the guitar struck, it was like I was overwhelmed. I had this huge sense of nostalgia. It's like all my childhood memories literally came flooding back. And I could just picture myself in my parents' living room with them all dressed up, going out to listen to. And the music just evoked all these memories. Very powerful thing. And like you said, it was literally the fuse that lit the spark for my wanting to return to Nigeria to take a look at my own past and see what had happened to some of these elders, what had happened to the country itself. You know,
and you refer to some of these elders, and those are the people that you go looking for. You go looking for the musicians who were making the music that you heard as that 5 to mid-teen-year-old in that period you lived in Nigeria. Is there one type of Nigerian music? It's really too simplistic. Even from watching the documentary, I can see that there's such a variety of traditions that feeds into what happens in Nigerian music.
Indeed. You have to remember it's a country with, you know, so many ethnic tribes fused together, pulled together into one country. So, of course, the beauty of that is that we have so much diversity and such a rich musical, you know, heritage behind us. You have the Igbos who sing in their own language. You have the Yoruba singing in their own language, the Hausas and the Shakiris. So the variety of music, the percussion, everyone is very unique. You know, each distinct ethnic group has their own flavor they bring to music, and it's something really special. It really is.
I suppose if we were to trace a kind of a rough history, or really a pencil sketch of the history, we go from high life music, you might explain what we mean by that, into the juju that you were speaking about, and then beyond that, really into Afrobeat. That's the trajectory.
Yes, indeed. You know, the high life music came out of the era of independence in the 50s and 60s. And of course, a lot of high life music evolved out of ballroom and waltzes and jazz music and the calypso as well, which a lot of these elders were listening to back then. High life music is very horn driven, big band. It's like very big band driven. And the music is very sweet and very optimistic. You can hear it. Mm. It's very joyful. The chords are very joyful. You have all these major thirds they play within the music. And that's captured because of what was going on in the nation at the time. And then, of course, you move that. Once the war came, high life music kind of vanished and disappeared. And then juju music began to take center stage. And, of course, the country was flush with petrodollars. You had juju music. Mm. That all came to the forefront. And then, of course, the years of turbulence and corruption. People like Fela, or musicians like the late, great Fela Kuti, emerged out of that. And protest music in the form of Afrobeat began to take center stage.
One of the contributors to the documentary, who kind of spans the entire period almost, is Isi Orinze, who at the very beginning of the documentary says, I haven't played the trumpet now in a long time. Don't know if my lip would be able to manage this at all. Then he puts the instrument up to his lips, and he sounded as if, you know, he's been practicing all day.
Indeed.
He lived through all of it, really, didn't he?
Yes, indeed he did. You know, rose from humble beginnings as a teacher, became a big band leader, became a musical statesman, a figure who the government called upon to entertain visiting dignitaries. And of course, the Biafra War put an end to his career, and somehow he still managed to eke out a living. So, you know, his life story formed a trajectory of the nation's history as well. And, you know, quite a really remarkable figure now. And a treasure for the nation as well, Isi Orinze.
Yeah, and his big hit?
Nike Nike. You know, that's the interesting thing about Nike Nike was, like, I remember distinctively, I mean, the minute he put his horn to his lips and began to play that song, I remember when first I'd heard it. It was a music, it had become a song you'd heard when Nigerian military bands were practicing. Well, I was a member of the Boy Scout or the Boys Brigade when I was little in Nigeria. And it's one of those songs you heard. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So I began to think it was a police song or something. But it wasn't until Isi Arinze played it that day of the interview. And I subsequently dig and thought, wow, this was actually an original he had cut years ago, which had since become like a staple.
Yeah, let's have a listen to Isi Arinze and Nike Nike.
Kaya lolo, nalo no nike nike. Nike nike, kaya lolo, nalo no nike nike. Loba, 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 loba. Nike nike, kaya lolo, nalo no nike nike. Loba, 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 loba.
There we go, a little flavour there of Nike Nike from Isi Arinze. It's one of, he's one of the musicians who features in the documentary I'm speaking about this evening, Elders Corner, and it's writer and director Shiji Awanika is with me on the line from New York. Just as we finish up, Shiji, there are two important stories I think that we need to touch before we finish. First of all, we've spoken mostly about male artists up until this point, but there were important and vital female artists in there as well.
Indeed. Notably, the Lijadu sisters, who were one of the first we began to see, who they became very visible in a male-dominated field. The Lijadu sisters in the 70s, you know, very outspoken, very beautiful. They were twins as well. They're one of the very first you began to really see publicly as female musicians in a field dominated by the men, you know?
Yeah.
And they were very special.
Well, listen, lovely to speak with you this evening, Shiji, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. That's Shiji Awanika there, the director and writer of the documentary Elders Corner, which will screen tomorrow, Wednesday the 25th at the Lighthouse Cinema, 6:30 p.m. as part of the inaugural Africa Day Film Festival. Full information or to book a free ticket, visit africaday.ie. Twenty-one and a half minutes to 8 on Tuesday night, Serena. After reading Ulysses, photographer Deirdre Brennan was inspired to use the structure of Joyce's novel to explore the themes of culture, politics, character and social struggle in modern Dublin. Her new book, Following Ulysses, is the culmination of a 10-year photographic project, each photograph corresponding to one of the 18 episodes in Ulysses. Delighted to have Deirdre Brennan with me in studio this evening. Was it a specific reading of it at the time? What kind of put you off into this frame of mind, Deirdre? I want to do this as photographs, and I want to do it as many of them contemporary photographs, in fact.
Well, thank you very much for having me, first of all. Well, the initial idea, I was living in New York at the time, and on the 100th anniversary in 2004, I was at home and I thought I would do follow the steps of Leopold and Stephen through Dublin just one day, you know, because Ulysses is just set in one day. So I looked at the map. I had just started reading Ulysses. So I looked at the map and I thought, there's no way I can do this in one day. And plus, you know, with street photography, you could be wandering around all day and see nothing interesting. So it turned into a 10 to 12 year project. And I suppose it had always been an ambition of mine to read Ulysses. I've read it 3 times and I don't profess to be any expert on it. I think I would need to read it 10 times to truly understand it. But I started reading it when I went back to New York, and
The pictures started to go. You grew up on Camden Street.
Kind
of puts you in Bloom territory, really,
so
doesn't
it? There's so many, like, reading Ulysses, so many characters from Camden Street who would not have been out of place in Ulysses. It was like full of eccentric old ladies with old shops, and it was just a wonderful place to grow up with. And my father was a photographer also. So,
in fact, let me go to a real character photograph that's there, because I think this one's is particularly apt in terms of what you're saying about Ulysses and about the book. This is, I'm going to tweet now, John Byrne surrounded by his dogs at RTE Arena, if you want to see the images that Deirdre Brennan is speaking to us about. So I'll describe the image. It's a man sitting on a doorstep and three beautiful dogs, two of them up in his lap, one of them sitting down in front of him. Maybe just tell me what struck you about this particular photograph and how it came about, Deirdre.
Well, I had actually known John for a number of years. I had a little doggy that was not unlike Roxy in the front. So I used to talk to John on the streets about the dogs, and we used to have great conversations about how beautiful they were. I'm a dog lover myself. And so we had sort of a friendship. And I had never wanted to take his photograph because I just didn't think it was appropriate. There was no need. But one day I was walking up Henry Street and I went over to say hello to him. And I just felt that they looked like a pre-Raphaelite painting, all of their own accord. And then today I was thinking about the photograph, and I was thinking about how the Mona Lisa is a triangular, the composition is a triangle. So it's also like a Leonardo da Vinci.
You couldn't, composition. If you tried to get three dogs and a man to pose in that, it wouldn't happen.
But I take no credit for this, because they did this all of their own accord.
People might know John Byrne, they might know the story of him, in fact.
Yeah, he jumped into the Liffey to. So anyway, I asked John.
To explain why he went into the Liffey was to save a
Liffey. He was begging, he was on O'Connell Street. And somebody came along and threw his rabbit Barney into the Liffey. So he had told me he had done a life-saving course as a teenager, so he knew how to swim. So he jumped in, Barney died, but he gave him the kiss of life and he brought him back to life. And then the level of the Liffey was low that day, so he swam over to the shore and he was rescued. I mean, you can see the footage on YouTube.
Yeah, I remember that it was a big story at the time. But, and there's a touch of, it's the kind of story that Joyce would have loved, isn't it?
Well, I absolutely feel that story would have been in Ulysses, and I feel it would have been when Leopold Bloom was walking over O'Connell Bridge. He would have seen John and the dogs in the distance, and he would have been mulling over that story in his head, and he would have approached him, because Bloom did have he was very charitable to his fellow human beings. And so I feel John and the dogs would, and I was thinking today, would Joyce have, because Joyce was afraid of dogs, would he have added a little, and now these dogs are very well behaved and they would never nip anybody.
And it's a wonderful picture.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the image that is on the cover of the book. And again, we'll tweet this again. The book, by the way, I should say, is called Images Following Ulysses, Divine and Human. Images Divine and Human Following Ulysses is the title. And Deirdre Brennan, the photographer who has put it together. And we're looking at a monument here. History is such a huge part of Ulysses as well, and where the empire and where Ireland was at, the British Empire and Ireland were at that particular time, is obviously important in the storytelling as well. Tell me a little bit about this particular image. It's the Daniel O'Connell Monument. Are we on O'Connell Street with this?
I think I'm crossing the road. I'm probably in the middle of the road, crossing from the quay. So I'm not exactly sure. I'm just coming on to it. But this was this is an in-camera double exposure, and I did this work.
So we have the picture of the kind of the base of the monument
itself.
But then there's like a mist around it, and people sitting.
I photograph the clouds. I take a picture. The camera does a double exposure in camera, so there's no initial manipulation. It's a straight in camera double exposure, but it can be quite tricky to, you have to be very quick to get the clouds. You know, you take the picture and then you take a picture, you put the camera up to the sky, and you try and pick the clouds that you think will fit best with the image.
And choosing that as the cover image for the book, that must say something about what you felt about its importance in the overall scheme.
Well, I feel it, the colour, the Grecian blue, you know, it's the colour of Ulysses. But I took, it was really, this was at the beginning, this was around the time of the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit, like I make a living as a commercial photographer, and that, you know, I have a parallel career as a commercial photographer and a documentary photographer. So all my commercial work just stopped overnight.
Yeah.
So it was really important to me to use the time productively and to create a body of work about the history of the pandemic in Dublin. And I was really struggling about how to do it. I was doing the empty streets and I was like, oh, this isn't working. And then I think it was the 7th of April, I heard someone say double exposure. So that clicked something in, that gave me the idea.
To go about it in this way.
To create, and the double exposure creates type of a surreal image, and it was a reflection of the times.
There are many images throughout the several that are in the book that refer to the Extinction Rebellion is in there. There are references to various campaigns, political and otherwise, social campaigns throughout the city, very contemporary campaigns. Let's look at one of the specifics of that. This is a picture of a woman, is it here, Repeal the Eighth. This was obviously around the time of that particular campaign.
Campaign, yeah.
And we'll tweet that image now at RTE Arena. So just describe it to us, if you would, Deirdre.
Well, it was one of the beginning of one of the marches up at Merrion Square, and the woman is wearing a Victorian costume, not unlike the dress that would have been worn in 1904. The parallels with Ulysses is like the oxen of the sun scene when Bloom goes to visit Mina Purefoy in Hollis Street Hospital, and Stephen's medical friends get rowdy and they start talking about abortion and contraception and fertility, which seems like very unusual for a talk like that in 1904.
Yeah, and it's one of the ways that you brought it
into
this.
That I brought it in, that it was such a contemporary issue then.
Let me just mention one final image, which is of a young girl with a dog. It's in outer space as we speak.
Well, that picture that's in the Liberties, and that was selected for the Portrait of Humanity, which is published by the British Journal of Photography. And then in 2020, they decided to have an exhibition in outer space. So a screen went up into outer space. So Roxy and Grace were in outer space.
As is the work of Deirdre Brennan.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much.
That's Deirdre Brennan, and the book that Deirdre was speaking to us about, Images Divine and Human, Following Ulysses, is published by High Tone Books, and you can get full information on hightonebooks.ie. The 2022 Dublin Dance Festival is well underway at this stage. You may recall we had dancers and choreographers Catherine Young, Finola Cronin, Junkle Thomas, Megan Kennedy on the show recently. This is, of course, the first summer in 3 years that the Dance Festival has been open to the public for live performance. Shona McRimmon has been to see four of the shows for us, and delighted to say that she's with me in studio this evening. A real buzz absolutely around the festival this year, Shona, because there has been nothing really in terms of the dance festival for the last couple of years, except online. Now, that was great that was done, but there's nothing to compare to the real thing, is there?
There is nothing to compare to live performance, live music, live movement, no substitute at all. So there was absolutely a complete kind of visceral buzz evident at every performance. You felt the audiences were on the edge of their seats before anything happened, just to be in the presence of live performance.
And particularly dance, you know, I know all of the performing arts had their own set of difficulties, but dance, and many of the choreographers and dancers that I've spoken to since, this idea of, you know, physical contact, physical movement, it's not always solos. It's about a core. It's about duets. It's about pas de deux. It's about, you know, groups of people moving. It's very seldom a solo exercise.
Completely. And I think that they had to be very inventive, you know, when they were doing these filmed pieces for Zoom and when the festival went virtual. And they did show remarkable ingenuity. But I think that what this festival has done is to show really the power of the body In all kinds of ways. And I mean, the new director who's in seems to have made
a
particular... new director is Jasmine Chiodi, and she's from Argentina. And she has been living in Ireland since 2005. But I think she brought a particular sensibility, very alert to what everybody has been through, and really giving us a celebration of dance, of movement, of bodies, and also a feeling of community, the collective diversity, being alert to change and turbulence. All of these things were present.
Right. Let's talk about the specifics of some of the shows. And the opening show at Sigi Fan, I hope I'm saying that correctly, featured performers and choreographers from Mali, Senegal and Burkina Faso. So yet again, we could not have had anybody from other than 2 miles down the road in our festivals for a long period of time. Tell me about that show and what that energy brought.
The energy of this show, which opened the festival, was extraordinary because, you know, it started very slowly. You saw this group of athletic dancers from West Africa, from the three countries that you've mentioned, which have something in common with them, but due to colonization, were divided up, you know, French colonies. And the choreographers and dancers all came together to create this extraordinary dance. The choreographer was originally a hip-hop dancer, but this was turning hip-hop on its head completely. And the pulsating music was amazing. But I think that as well as the loud bass that you get with that kind of beat, sometimes it was just their own breath creating the rhythm, and you could hear their bare feet just stamping on the ground.
Yeah.
And that was as hypnotic
as any hip-hop bass beat.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and let me move on then to Catherine Young. I said she was in with us last week, recalling how she had intended to make a work all about divisiveness, and then Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine and she had a whole bundle of divisiveness to deal with there. But she also really is talking about community in this. A Call to You is the work itself. Tell me a bit about it.
Again, it was underlying this theme of the collective, but also being alert to the outsider or the person who feels excluded. And it was, I think, perhaps it was the Ukrainian situation that inspired the, or maybe underlined the, folk dance element.
Yeah, she told me about one of the dancers in the group was of Ukrainian origin, and they brought then these Ukrainian folk dances with them, which were then woven into the material
extremely well. But what was interesting was that you could see layers of other folk dances, including you know, set dancing and ceilidh dancing, and you know, Jewish dancing, and you know, klezmer music, and all of that, and Arabic dancing as well, and just a real sense of joy and celebration and community, and that just kind of seemed to be there right through the whole week, that we were given visual treats as well as everything else.
Well, let's move on to another one that to me sounds as if it's full of energy. If my translation is possibly correct, Encantado, Brazilian choreographer here, Leo Rodrigues. What are we talking about with Encantado?
Where to start is really the question here. I mean, it starts, if you can believe it, with just this painstaking, minute unfolding of multicolored fabrics. I mean, in vivid colors like red and orange and turquoise and bright green and yellow. And then they're slowly unfolded. So they create this kind of sea of fabric on the ground. But you don't know whether it's the carpet moving, whether it's these naked bodies. They were costumed in their own skin. And then suddenly they take these pieces of fabric they twist them, they knot them, they swaddle them, they sway themselves in it, and they create these magical worlds.
And musically, what are we listening to here?
We're listening to the music of the Guarani tribe, of Brazil, an endangered tribe, who have been trying to call attention to the worlds that are going to disappear because of climate crisis, but also, again, a sense of dreamlike worlds. They create, you know, almost like a favela of Brazil on fire, or a rainforest. They create, you know, scarlet macaws and zebras and exotic
Sounds
animals,
but
also
yeah.
just... you know, life in all its wonderful
We've just been speaking about Joyce and Ulysses. The show number four was that you're talking about this evening, a film installation by Anya Stapleton, Somewhere in the Body, inspired by Lucia Joyce, in fact, and her link to the novel Finnegan's Wake, written by James Joyce. What did Anya Stapleton give us in this film work?
Well, Anya Stapleton has been... working on Lucia Joyce as an inspiration. This is the third work that she has created, and this is a film in its that stands alone, because she has been looking at how Finnegan's Wake is, you know, is sometimes seen as a kind of, you know, sleep and dreaming sequence, with, again, all kind of shift shaping going on, and she uses two performers. Colin Dunn, who is many characters. He could be Joyce, the father. He could be Joyce, the writer. He could be Shem or Sean or any of the characters in Finnegan's Wake. And then there's this sylph-like ghost woman, the Colleen Bawn, who actually is evoked in Finnegan's Wake. And perhaps that's Lucia.
Yeah.
And again, but there's this also this concentration on light. There are light sculptures. They are almost like neon sticks of bright colours. And again, because Lucia's name means light.
Right.
But also the irony of James Joyce, whose own light was fading in his eyes, was just a lovely...
You've mentioned the new artistic director, Jasmine Chiodi, and certainly from what you're saying, her choices have been very successful so far. What are you looking forward to seeing, particularly in the closing days?
I'm looking forward to more energy, I would say. The show that opened at the Abbey and is on again tomorrow, the flamenco. There's also Jan Martin's show about protest, Any Attempt... to end this will end up in crushed bones, is really how it goes on. And also there's Junk.
Fionnuala Cronin and Michael Murphy. What a combination that
will
be.
What a combination, absolutely.
Okay, well listen, thanks for coming in to tell us about what you have seen so far and those shows you're looking forward to, that Shona McRaemon. And the Dublin Dance Festival continues through until the 29th of May, and you can find out further details on the website, which is dublindancefestival.ie.